spreading the gospel of Christ. It's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So here's the power of God to salvation. Paul's not ashamed of it. He's going to spread it far and wide all over the world. It's for everybody, Jew first and also for the Greek. And in it you have this righteousness of God that's shown to us, his righteousness in dealing with mankind throughout history, and what he expects from us in the way of righteousness as well. And it's revealed from faith to faith, the faith that God has revealed to us that we might make it our faith, from faith to faith, objective to subjective. The just then will live by faith. Beautiful passage. Our outline of Romans, you have this first great section, which I think is really the core of the book, 8 chapters where Paul talks about how the gospel saves the sinner and takes us through that. We have this introduction that we just covered. We'll talk about in this next section, starting this morning, how that all have sinned and need salvation, and then how the gospel saves by grace through faith, and then what faith requires as far as a changed life is concerned. Then there's a little section in here, chapters 9, 10, and 11, that deals with God's relationship with physical Israel and spiritual Israel, and how the gospel in its plan and its fruition fits into God's plan for both national and spiritual Israel. And we'll see that explained pretty thoroughly in those chapters. And then you have the last section, which is a very practical section. We'll talk about, what it means to live as a Christian, some particular aspects of that life and what it means in our relationships with one another. Great section there, starting in verse 12 and going through the end of the book. Chapter 12 and going through the end of the book. So we're picking up this morning in chapter 1 and verse 18. This is a well-known passage. I think we need to make sure we make the connection. I don't know what happened to my thing again went out. Yeah, there it comes. Thank you. I don't know what happened. My father-in-law used to say, when I first started preaching, I was one of the first preachers probably to start using a computer to do my lessons. And he said I was a computer preacher and couldn't preach without a computer. And I'm getting to where I can't preach without PowerPoint either. So if that ever happens, I guess I'll just stand here and look at you. I don't know. I'm kidding. I think I could do it. What I was saying was, God's power to salvation, the gospel, kind of begs this next question. If the gospel is God's power to salvation, what do we need saving from? And why do we need saving from it? Right? So that's sort of, Paul's very logical. We'll see this, that he'll make a point and he'll prove it, and then it sort of leaves you with, well, what about this? You want to ask another question. And he anticipates that and he answers it. All the way through these first 8 chapters, we'll see a good bit of that. So the question here is, why must God save us from his own wrath? Verse 18 says, for the wrath of God is revealed. For the wrath of God is revealed. That answers the question of what do we need saving from, right? The gospel is God's power to salvation. What do we need saving from? The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. God's wrath is a necessary response. It comes from his essence and from his nature. His wrath against sin and unrighteousness is a necessary response to his righteous nature being assaulted by human sin. I want you to understand, we need to understand, that in this relationship between God and man, man is the aggressor. Man is the violator of the will of God. Man is the one who by his actions attacks God. He starts the war. He fires the first shot. Yesterday was the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, right? The Japanese fired the first shot. They were sorry they did that. We fired the first shot at God. We're going to be sorry that we do that. That's in essence what's being said. So, in Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 13, God's nature is this. His eyes are purer than to behold evil. He cannot look upon wickedness. That's just who God is. by nature. In Romans chapter 8 and verse 7, Paul will say that the carnal mind is enmity against God. In chapter 4 and verse 4 of James, he says, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity against God?" Somebody tell me what enmity means. What's enmity? Opposition, yes. One synonym is hostility. So we have been hostile to God. We have opposed God. We have set ourselves against Him by committing sin. You see, we were the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. We started it. Okay? So we have naturally aroused the wrath of God. That's our fault, not His. Why do we need to be saved from God's wrath? Because we made Him mad. We made Him mad by rejecting His righteous and just will. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 6, Paul talking about sinful activities that Christians should not engage in, he says, "Let no one deceive you with empty words. Because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience." What did you do if you're a parent and you had a disobedient child? You discipline them, right? That's if you're worthwhile. Which Lorenzo's saying is, just because we have raised the ire of God's wrath doesn't mean that He's going to express His wrath upon us immediately, and He does not. Human history, though, in fact, the whole story of the gospel is that He's giving us a really big second chance. He's been patient with humankind. You know, He could have sent destruction of everybody and everything immediately. That would have been just, but that's not what He's done. In fact, this is the gospel, is God's power to salvation. That's a story of love and of patience and of long suffering. And well-made point, I think, Lorenzo, that we needed to insert here into this discussion, because, yeah, sure, we've aroused God's wrath, but that doesn't mean He immediately responds with the full force of His wrath against us. He does not do that, and in fact, anything but that. But you have in Ephesians 5, 6, because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. You have a similar passage in Colossians, put to death your members that are on the earth, Colossians 3, 5, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. So, God's wrath is just, and we need saving from it. We have generated it. We have instigated it. We have aroused it. Verses 19 and 20 then, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Sinners are without excuse for violating the will of God, for opposing Him in the way that they have. And the reason that they're without excuse is God's nature has been shown to man in creation. While in creation we may not see everything about God, we can learn an awful lot about Him. His eternal power, His divinity, we see His wisdom, we see His provision and benevolence toward mankind in creation. We see a lot of the goodness of God in creation. And so mankind has no reason to oppose God as they have. That's Paul's beginning argument here. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge, and there is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Every nation on earth, every people on earth can look up at the sky, can observe the heavens, can see the creation, and know about the power, the eternal nature, and the goodness of God. Nobody on the face of the planet has ever had an excuse to purposely oppose God, because He's been nothing but good to us. He is powerful and it's just senseless for us to oppose him. In Acts chapter 14, Paul is trying to make the same argument to the people of Lystra. You remember they were pagans and they were trying to sacrifice to he and Barnabas as if they were gods. In Acts 14 and verse 17, it says, "He did not leave himself, God did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven, fruitful seasons, filling our heart with food and gladness." One word to focus on there is the word witness. God is testifying to us in the blessings that he gives us. So the food that you eat is a testimony of God. The rain that you get on your crops is a testimony of the goodness of God. So we see in creation not only his power and his divinity, but also his goodness in creation. This is a witness to God. Paul is saying to those idolaters, those pagans in Lystra, look, God can't be this cow. You know, God can't be these images that you have. God is the one who gives you your food to eat. God is the one who sends the rain. You can't think of him like this. That's what he's telling them. And that's kind of the same argument that he's going to get to here. So I'm going to do this little experiment. I posted this picture this last week on Facebook. It was of a sunset that occurred this week. What does that say about us, about the nature of our Creator? Just that sunset. What does it say? What do you, first of all, what's your express? What do you feel when you just see that picture? Yeah, there's beauty. There is beauty in that. And we know that that had to be some being far, far greater than ourselves that's providing that. So we just look at that and God provides us with beauty. And so he's blessing us. He's wanting to give us good things. And he must be very, very powerful in order to have created something like that. Right? And we can also, I think, draw some other conclusions about it concerning one who would create all that and provide all that and continues to do that throughout all of human history. He must not be limited by time. So Paul says we can look at the creation and perceive his everlasting power and divinity. Can you see that in that picture? It's all around us all the time, isn't it? Now, that having said, mankind from the creation has been able to see sunsets like that, I would say. But he hasn't always accepted God. He hasn't always treated God with the kind of respect and love that's due to one who provides these things for us every day. So man has knowingly perverted the glory of God into images of created things, bringing God's wrath upon ourselves. In 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and verse 25, God says, "They have forsaken me," talking about his people Israel, "they have forsaken me and burned incense to other gods that they might provoke me to anger." I want you to think about that. They have forsaken me. They know that I can't be like these idol gods. You could look at that sunset and know that God can't be, you know, some kind of idol. But they've turned to idols and they provoked me to anger, he says. 2 Chronicles 34 and verse 25. Psalm 78 and verse 58. "They provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images." In fact, here's a bit of trivia for you. Over 60 times in the Old Testament, the writers will say, the inspired writers will say, that man provoked God. Why is God mad at us? Why is God's wrath just? We provoked him over and over and over and over again. We provoke him with our sin. We provoke him when we don't acknowledge his everlasting power and divinity, but try to make it into something else. Something of our own achievement, something of our own doing. So that provokes God. That's what Paul is getting to then back in Romans. Look at it again. His attributes are seen, verse 20, being understood by the things that are made, his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. So men do not believe God. They have darkened their hearts by foolish pride and self-will. Ephesians 2 and verse 3 talks about those in the world whom we used to be a part of, even if we're Christians today, who conduct themselves in the lust of the flesh according to the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and we're by nature children of wrath. Children of wrath, because we're doing what we want to do instead of what God has directed us to do. Look at Ephesians 4. Look at Ephesians 4 and verse 17. This I say therefore and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened. In other words, they can't see who God is anymore. Being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over to lewdness to work all uncleanness with greediness. So it's the picture there that Paul has of people have entered into darkness because that's their choice. They wanted to. They've stayed in darkness and they can't really see who God is and they are not honoring him as God. Is that God's fault? What that is. God made man upright. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 29. God made man upright, but he has sought out many inventions, many schemes. All that belongs to man's responsibility and not God's. You'll have thoughts about that through verse 22. Verse 22, by the way, is a powerful verse, I think. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. What you see there is human pride. Human pride is always going to be a barrier between us and God when we lift ourselves up higher than him. So that leads well right into what we're fixing to say. Man has provoked God in this way. And so what comes next in this context is three times the Apostle Paul will say, in essence, God gave them up or God gave them over. You keep on opposing God and rejecting him and running away from his will, and God's not a God that's going to force you to acknowledge him or to honor him or to do what he's asked you to do. He's given us free will. He's going to let you go your way. And so the text will talk about, as we'll see here in the next few verses, him giving people over to do what they were bent on doing, if you will. So let's look at that, starting in verse 24. It's the first one of those phrases. Let's see if I can find the right passage. All right, verse 24. Well, verse 23, they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image like corruptible man, birds, four-footed beasts, and creeping things. So that's the idolatry. Verse 24, therefore God gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. When we defile the nature of God in our minds, we defile ourselves. We are created in the image of God. And when we pervert that image in our minds through our own self-will, pride, and disobedience, then we are also then defiling the very nature and image of God ourselves. In Psalm 14, verses 1 through 4, the text starts, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." You remember that? So we often reference that in talking about atheists, but not really satisfied that the psalmist is talking about what we would consider an atheist in that passage. Let's read two or three verses there, Psalm 14. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They've done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call on the Lord? What the psalmist is describing there is not a denial of the existence of God. It's a refusal to recognize him for who he is. It's a refusal to submit to him and honor him and call upon him. And again, out of pride, people want to go their own way, do their own thing, be led away by their own lusts. So going back to Romans, God gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. They worshiped and served the creature than the Creator. The word uncleanness in that passage in Romans refers to, obviously, impurity of body, mind, or soul. It's the dirty mind. We say today somebody has a dirty mind. The dirty mind, or it's the blackened heart. It's the person who's constantly focused on bad things in this world and things that are immoral and unjust and perverted. In the New Testament, that word unclean or uncleanness is most often connected with sexual immorality or perversion. It's used quite a number of times like that, and that's what it's leading into, as we'll see momentarily here in Romans chapter 1. In 1 Corinthians 12, verse 21, you can read the connection between uncleanness and fornication. Galatians 5:19, in the works of the flesh there, fornication, uncleanness are mentioned right next to one another in that list of sins. Fornication, uncleanness, lewdness. In Ephesians 5, fornication and all uncleanness are mentioned together. So you have a dirty mind that produces filthy acts, sexual immorality. That's the connection. Fornication, by the way, sexual immorality, is a really broad term in the original language. It describes all kinds of sexual sins. A lot of times we think it just might refer to premarital sexual relations or something like that, but it includes, actually, initially included was meant to describe prostitution, but many other sins were kind of fell into its use over the centuries. And by the time you get to the Koine Greek of the first century, it included about every kind of sexual sin you could imagine would be described by that term. So my point is, why do people engage in sexual immorality? Well, because they want to. Because they got dirty minds and they've allowed themselves to focus on their own lusts and pleasures, and in their pride, that's what they want. And so that's what they're going to do. All of that's all connected to what we just talked about. Human pride, turning away from the nature of God, doing what we want to do. All of that's connected together. So, God gave them up to that way of thinking because that's the way they were going. And then in verses 26 and 27, God gave them up, Paul will say, to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burn in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful, receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. The word vile, as the New King James has it there, is a word which means degrading, shameful. The word natural, on the other hand, comes from a phusikos, which we get our word physical from that, but Here it refers to inborn, natural, God-given order, including the instincts. But I like that phrase. I think Thayer uses it, maybe some others do, the natural, God-given order. So God has arranged things in nature in certain ways. And frankly, just not to be too very blunt, but you don't have to be too familiar with human anatomy to know that God created them male and female, and each one of those genders has a part to play in human procreation, in human relations, and there's no, you know, going from one to the other. There's a natural order here that God has created. This is God's order. This is God's order of things. And somebody says, well, I see that's God's. I know God's great and he's powerful and he's wise and he gives us the sunset and he gives us our food to eat and he gives us everything and such a great God, but I just don't like his order, so I'm going to mess with that. And I was born a man, but you know, I'm going to decide I'm going to be a woman or I'm going to be something in between or fluid gender. I almost said Jude Flinder, but fluid gender, as one famous person described himself recently. What is that? That's exactly what's being described. God gave people up to do that because they refused to know him. They refused to respect the natural order of things. And that, by the way, you know, I know our society is devolving into a terrible place right now as far as all of that is concerned, but we're kidding ourselves if we think that's the first time in human history it's ever happened. It was the Greco-Roman society in which Paul lived was filled with that sort of thinking and behavior. That's why he's writing about it, especially to the Romans, where it would be very prevalent, so that they might see the problems with it as well. Yes. Right. God gives us the natural desires. He gives us a way to have those desires met and fulfilled within, again, his order of things. And trouble is, we want to do it our way again. We want to go outside of that order that he has designed, thinking, you know, well, our way is better. The word natural use there of male and female bodies is the union that's approved by God that is honorable. And this is getting right at what Al was saying, that, you know, marriage is honorable and the bed undefiled. There's God's way of bringing that relationship between male and female to fruition. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 through 7, let every man have his own wife, let every woman have her own husband. That tells us a lot of things right there about God's intention and his design for the natural order. Among other things, it tells us, by the way, that polygamy is wrong. Let every man have his own wife, let every woman... Does that sound like polygamy is okay? No. See, that's lots of perverted ideas that people have all over the world, one way or the other on all of this, that are just outside of what God has designed and intended and expressed in his word. The unnatural use of the male and female bodies is obviously forbidden for citizens of the kingdom of heaven. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of heaven? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites. And that covers, I think, everything that we might be talking about in the way of those kinds of perversions. They're all covered there. You're not going to inherit the kingdom of God if you continue to practice those. The good news is, by the way, when we talk about the power of the gospel, which is kind of, remember, the foundation of what we're talking about right now, a person might do any or all of that and still be able to find salvation if they turn away from it. That's the power of the gospel. And you see that right there in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, don't you? As Paul says, such were some of you. Some of the Corinthians had been involved in all of that, but now he calls them saints, holy ones, people who've been washed clean of all of that. So it's not that God's wrath, as we talked about to begin with, it's not that, well, he's just decided everybody who ever does this one time in their lives or whatever is, you know, he's going to burn them up for all eternity. No, God says, you've hit me in the face, you violated my will, I still love you, I still want to save you, and here's the gospel. And if you'll respond to that through faith in the merits of the blood of Christ, you can be saved. But getting back to the point here, God gave them up to their vile passions, and that unnatural use is forbidden. Sodom and Gomorrah, we sometimes are afraid of going back to that example because, of course, it's an Old Testament example, and we need to be cautious about using Old Testament passages to prove some of these things to our friends and neighbors. But that Old Testament example is quoted in Jude verse 7, New Testament, specifically referred to Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities around them, in a similar manner, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example. Example for who? Us, right? Suffering the vengeance of fire. So we need to learn from that. Let's quickly look at this last section. Right. Brent's making a good point. It's not that the sexual immorality is just because it's wrong because it's connected to idolatry. It's wrong because it's wrong. Okay? And the connection, there is a connection between sexual immorality and idolatry, especially in the Old Testament, which is pretty obviously portrayed throughout the Old Testament scriptures. But that's not really Paul's point here. Paul's point is people perverted the idea of God. First of all, the idolatry is perverting the idea of God, and then they perverted themselves by going against God's natural order. That's really the line of thought. And so there are all of these sins, they're not wrong because of their connection to idolatry. They're wrong because they're against God's way. They're against God's order. So God gave them over to a debased mind. I appreciate the comment, Brent. Verse 28. Reprobate, failing the test. Yeah, debased, I think this version is saying, but reprobate, the idea of you just totally failed. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. So when the mind is debased, behavior will be unfit. Where did Jesus say that sin comes from? Out of heart. It's what's in you. That's what comes out. When what is in you is bad, what comes out will be bad. So this word debased means not approved, or as Brother Pete was mentioning, reprobate, failing the test, all those words are synonyms. Fitting refers to what is proper or becoming. So here's a long list of things, and we don't really have the time to go through and in detail define every one of those. Most of us know what most of that is referring to, but some of them are more general terms like unrighteousness. That's just doing stuff that's not right. Okay, that includes everything. Then you have, again, sexual immorality that's mentioned, wickedness, covetousness, this illicit desire for something that's somebody else's, that's a desire of the flesh, maliciousness, a hatred where you just want to hurt somebody because you hate them, envy, murder, strife, fighting with one another, deceit, evil-mindedness is in that list, just thinking bad and bad things on a kind of continual basis. He goes on and talks about those who are whisperers. What is that? Gossip. Yeah, that's right in there with these other sins. Backbiters, talk about people behind their back in a negative way. Haters of God. You know, we got people in our society that are haters of God, and they frankly just express it in the media, wherever. I'm just hearing it too much nowadays. People who just hate God, hate who God is, hate what His Word is. They're violent. What about violence in our society? We got any of that? And even Christians sometimes who try to justify it. Again, proud, boasters, all of those things go together. Inventors of evil things. If there's not enough bad going on in the world, we invent something bad to do. Seems like that's coming up more and more every day. Disobedient to parents. Again, some of these things are, we think, well, this is just an egregious, awful sin. And some of these other things, well, that's really common. We see them all the time. But it's all the same thing to God. It's turning away from His will to, in pride, do what we want to do. And these ideas of undiscerning, you don't know the difference between right and wrong. I am appalled at times by folks that just don't know the difference between right and wrong. We had a national football coach, college football coach, use a big bad word talking to his team a couple of weeks ago. And the justifications for that, well, what's wrong with that? what's wrong with using that kind of language? What's wrong? You got to be kidding. What's wrong with it for a coach to use that kind of language? And so it's unbelievable. Well, we need to stop there. I appreciate your good attention. We may just touch on a little bit of this again before we get into chapter 2 Wednesday night. Thanks for your help and attention this morning.